Welcome to the Andy Social Podcast. This is episode 163, and we have automotive technician Lara Gibson on this week's podcast. But before we kick into it, if we haven't met already, my name's Andy Dowling, and sometimes I prance around on stage in the Australian metal band Lord. And if you love a bit of old school heavy metal, you love some crunchy guitars, lots of guitar solos, lots of sing-alongs, very Iron Maiden ish, Queensryche, Judas Priest. We've got a bit of Symphony X, some chuggy guitars and stuff like that. There's lots of cool stuff. Anyway, go over to lord.net.au. We've got video clips, we've got streaming playlists, we've got all of our historical information and back catalogue, we've got an online store there, we've got heaps of stuff. It's really, really easy just to get a little bit of a taste of what our music's all about. So if you are curious, go over to lord.net.au. All of our social media links are there, so give us a follow on the socials and let us know what you think of the tunes. In addition to playing in a metal band, I also host the Self-Starter Podcast, which is all about small business, self-employment, and freelancing. So if you want to earn a little bit of extra coin on the side, or you want to escape the cubicle, so to speak, that stereotypical saying, or you want to start your own business, whatever it might be, go over to selfstarter.com.au, go and check it out. Maybe you know somebody who's a little bit frustrated and is trying to get through a challenging period in their self-employment journey, whatever it might be. I've covered a whole range of different scenarios and topics and stories in the podcast so far. Season one is now over as of December 2018, and season two will kick off in June of this year, 2019. So go and check it out. There's about 28-ish episodes, I think, that have been released so far. They're a fortnightly podcast, and there's an accompanied blog as well. And so for the next 6 months, the gap between season one and season two, I am updating my blog. So lots of good content there, good ideas and insights and tips and tricks and all that sort of stuff. And I'm also recording season two in advance as well. So if you know somebody that is running their own business, they're about to launch their own business, they're a freelancer, or maybe they've just got a really cool little side hustle where they earn a little bit of extra pocket money after hours or on the weekend or whatever it is, let me know. Shoot your guest recommendations through. I'm looking for people all across Australia. Originally, I started in regional Australia, but now I'm looking at our capital cities as well. So throw all the suggestions through and I'll have a sift through them and see whether there's any good candidates for season two of the Self-Starter Podcast. But if you're curious, selfstarter.com.au, go and check it out. This week's shout out. Each and every week, I thank somebody that supports me and the podcast and the band and does a whole range of different things. They can be in a range of different ways. Things such as guest recommendations. You can be buying some merch from the online store. I've got t-shirts, patches, USB passes with the first 100 episodes of the podcast. Spam, spam, spam. You can also shout me a beer via the PayPal button over at andysocial.net. You can leave a review on the internet. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. Small, big, it helps. It keeps me fueled, keeps me pumped, keeps this train a-rolling. And each week I thank one person that does something for me. And thank you so much, as always, to everybody that continues to do really cool things to support this podcast. So there can only be one each week. So this week's shout out is for Harry Newton, who's from Chicago in Illinois. Thank you so much, Harry, for just reaching out. This is so cool. And I see the stats. Look, I'll be completely honest. The split when it comes to location is probably 80% Australia, but then it goes into the US, UK, and then it goes to maybe New Zealand. I think Germany might be above New Zealand, but anyway, it sort of drops off pretty quickly after that. But I always love, when I get some feedback from my, friends in North America, because it means a hell of a lot to me. And I know podcasts are really big over there and there's a lot of competition. So for you guys to choose to listen to me, this Aussie do his own version of a podcast, it means a lot. So thank you so much. But anyway, the reason why I'm doing a shout out for Harry, sorry, I'm trying to spit that out, is Harry sent me a beer shout on the PayPal button over at andysocial.net and just said a quick message saying, keep up the great work. So thank you so much, Harry. Really appreciate it. That beer shout. And the reason why, I haven't mentioned this for quite some time, but the reason why I call it a beer shout is that when you guys send me a little thank you via that PayPal button, it just means that I can use that money to buy beer and it means that I'm not wasting my own money buying beer and I can spend it on the podcast. So it's a roundabout way of supporting the podcast, but you know what I mean. So it all helps. It all keeps this podcast going. It covers the hosting fees each month. It covers the editing that I pay TY to do. It covers any merch ideas that I have, or travel and equipment and getting out and talking to different guests as well. So it all goes back into the podcast and it keeps this whole thing going. So things such as this mean a hell of a lot. So thank you so much, Harry. Really appreciate it. Please shoot me a message when you hear this and I will send you out a little care pack in the post. I'll find some stuff laying around the place because we all love getting something in the mail. So thank you so much, Harry. Really, really appreciate it. This week's episode is with Lara Gibson. Lara is an automotive technician. Now, you might be fooled to think that Lara is a mechanic, and she is, but automotive technician is a far better term and more accurately describes the type of work that Lara does. Given that cars these days are so complex and the technology in it, in this exponential sort of world that we live in with the progression of technology, cars these days are borderline smarter than us. And they are teaching us how to drive and they're giving us all this information and assisting us as we move closer and closer to automation. And the cars as they stand now have got multiple computers in them. They need really complicated diagnostic equipment to be plugged up to cars to locate problems in the vehicle and even to repair the cars involves a high level of expertise and credentials. So Lara has been an automotive technician and has been working on vehicles for close to a decade now. She works at a large metro dealership in Melbourne, something that's got a high volume of cars on a day-to-day basis. So very potentially a stressful environment. And for me, I really wanted to chat to Lara because for me, driving a car and getting it serviced and going in for routine work or repairs, you only kind of see it from one perspective. And I really wanted to get a little bit more of an understanding of some of the things that Lara experiences and what life's like behind the scenes on a day-to-day basis as a technician working, especially in a large vehicle dealership as well. I've known Lara for quite a few years and we met through Metal. Lara's originally from Wodonga and we've got a bunch of mutual friends from some of the metal musicians out in Albury, Wodonga, and some of those guys now play in Malice's Wake, which is a thrash metal band from Melbourne. So a bit of a plug for those guys. They've got a new album coming out in 2019. So make sure you follow them on the socials, but a really, really cool thrash band if you love a bit of thrash metal. So I've known Lara for quite a few years and it was just really cool to chat about something different to metal, but really sort of touching on what she does on a day-to-day basis. And it's just it's a really cool chat. So enough of me. Please enjoy this really, really cool conversation with Lara Gibson. So a really dumb question to kick it off. What does a typical day look like in a workshop? Because for me, you know, walking into an office or whatever I'm doing for the day, there might be a schedule ahead or a particular structure that I have to follow. What's a typical day look like for you?
Well, in my role, my current role, basically turn up to work and the workshop controller will assign jobs and he's just managing the workflow that comes in. And you essentially just get assigned a job and that's pretty much all you've got to worry about then and there, just that job that you're doing. You've got to try and get it done, you know, within an appropriate amount of time, obviously. And then once that's done, you know, follow the procedures, pass it on through where it's got to go, and then you'll get assigned another job. So I've worked in about 5-6 different workshops and they've probably all run differently. But at the moment that's probably... it's probably one of the better ways I've seen it because as a tech, you're only worrying about the job you're working on at the time and you don't necessarily have your whole day planned out. You might have it all planned out, but you don't see it. So you just worry about getting the job done that you're doing and then move on to the next one rather than having it all there and you're worrying about, you know, your second or third job when you're still on your first one.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
It's kind of good because, yeah. I mean, you know, if your controller just mapped it all out and said, oh, you've got X amount of cars that you got to work on today and these are the cars, and you might get distracted with one really sort of complicated one that's later on in the day, and so you're not completely focused and
exactly
sort of in the moment with the one that you're dealing with at that time.
And it's not all planned out. It's sort of just the work's assigner that comes in because we've obviously got customers coming in, you know, from 7:30 in the morning up until about, I don't know, they can pop in the afternoon for a wait job at like 3 o'clock. So, you know, you've got to get the early jobs out first. So jobs might be going out at 10. So you obviously get those done first before a job that's going out at 4. And it's just, it's sort of a juggling process because the mass amount of volume we've got at work, you can't really plan for each individual job for the day. So you've just got to take it as it comes and see where everyone's at to, like, what are they up to? And you sort of have a mental plan because I've filled in for my workshop controller a few months ago. So you sort of see what everyone's up to and you have in your head who will get what jobs next. But then, as you said, someone might get stuck on a complicated job that's only been booked in for an hour and they go, oh, actually, it's going to take a bit longer. So you've got to make a decision if you're going to keep them on that and you have to shuffle the work around, or if you take them off that and they come back to it later on, if it's, you know, going out later, that sort of thing.
I think a lot of people, when they sort of, you know, you drop a car off to to go and get serviced or repaired, you don't really sort of understand. You sort of drop it off and just walk off and just forget about it. But, I mean, depending on, I guess, the qualification of who's in your team, like the different levels of qualification, there'd be different tasks assigned to people. So as you said, like people that rock up at 7:30 in the morning are usually, for the most part, people that are getting something routine done. And maybe even those afternoon ones as well that are going to hang around. But obviously you get a lot of things that are unexpected, cars just rocking up at any time of the day and overnight and all that. So would you have, I mean, for you, do you do sort of the routine stuff as well, or are you more sort of focused on sort of that, the more repair side?
I'm more of the diagnosis side of things, actually. So the routine stuff that comes in, you know, go out at 10 in the morning, it'll be things like a first service or a recall or something like that. The wait jobs are usually something simple, key coding, things that don't take a lot of time and are pretty straightforward. Things like diagnosis, you know, sort of rule of thumb is you allocate an hour. You know, you tell the customer, look, we'll look at it for an hour, and if it's diagnosed with then, great, we'll let you know. But if it's not, we'll have to come to you and say, look, we're going to need more time. So the routine stuff, we do sort of have structure in the workshop where, you know, you've got apprentices doing services and that sort of thing. We've got a couple of engine guys and gearbox guys. We've got other guys doing the big mechanical repairs, timing belts, water pumps, whatnot. Everyone's sort of, I guess they've all sort of got their jobs that they're assigned to, and you try to stick with that. But every now and then, you know, like whilst I was doing the controlling, both our engine guys were away. And we had about 4 rebuilds come in the same week. So it was a bit like, all right, well, we're going to have to look elsewhere who's capable of doing what, or can we just push the work back because we're not going to get it done like we would if they were both at work. So sort of a lot of workshops do that same thing, and it's you can do it if you're a big workshop, but I've always seen it as a bit of a negative because, as I've just said, we have 2 dedicated engine guys, they're both away, and then you've suddenly got no one to do the work. So yeah, it's good to have people doing that routine stuff, but I still think everyone needs to be sort of trained up to a certain extent in all areas, and then you have your people who specialise, because otherwise, you know, if someone's away, it's just a bit of a struggle of what you do, who you give it to.
It's like that typical thing in the workplace where you get you employ someone who's just shit hot at one particular thing, and then they decide, well, I've got annual leave piling up, so I'm going to go away. And everyone's like, oh, that's good, enjoy your time. And then they're out. And then suddenly the next day you go, what did they do? Yep. Or, oh, my God, like who else can do that? No one can do it.
And yeah, so the whole thing I've seen that apart. Happen a lot. Yeah. Yeah, my previous job, we had a lot of qualified techs leave. And I had the foresight to be like, all right, well, before they do leave, let's take the time we've got to train up some apprentices in these bigger jobs. But even having done that, once they all sort of left, we were looking around going, well, we don't really have anyone with the experience to this job, so what do we do now? We just sort of had to train people up as they were getting the jobs for the first time, which happens, you know. It's not the worst thing. It's just that whole fight or flight, sink or swim sort of syndrome. Like, people either pick it up or they don't, and you just got to see what happens.
It's a pretty fast-paced environment, or can be, especially if, I mean, because you're in the middle of the city, basically. You're in the metro area. So the volume of customers and cars coming through is going to be considerably more. And I know that you've also been sort of in a rural area as well. So you've seen sort of 2 ends of the spectrum as far as what life's just, like.
Just an enormous difference, you know, in the country. We did things a completely different way. And The way the workshop in Trolling is where I am now and the way it worked there, they're both polar opposites, but they both have their pros and cons.
Mm.
So back there, we, you know, it was a smaller workshop with a smaller amount of work. You know, you're still booked out, so everyone's got enough work for the day, but it was all very planned out, very structured, and it worked for some people, but it didn't for some others, because they just sort of, they'd focus on the next job and the job after that and get distracted from the job that they were doing at the time. But just the way they run it there, there's no way you'd be able to use that sort of style of controlling in a metro dealer, because you just, there's too many variables. You just can't plan for, you know, 70, 80 cars coming in. You don't know what's going to happen with them. You have customers walking in that aren't booked in because, you know, they've got an engine light on, and you sort of have to just accept it because you need to know if it's safe for them to drive their car. So you sort of have to, even though they're not booked in, you kind of have to prioritise them too, just to know if you can sort of get rid of them or if we need to keep their car, that sort of stuff. But, yeah, complete opposites in the size and the sheer volume of work versus the way they run the workshop, basically, yeah.
Did you struggle when you first sort of moved to Melbourne and went into this completely different workshop and dynamic and intensity than where you were previously?
Well, so because this is the second company I've been with whilst I've been in Melbourne, and again, going back to the previous, that was still a busy metro dealer, but they did things a bit sort of, I guess in the middle of the two. So, would get the work coming in and dish it out, but they'd sort of allocate, you know, a whole bunch of jobs to a person for the day, but it wasn't as structured as in the country.
Mm.
So, there was sort of more to keep track of because, I guess, you know, this work was coming in and you'd have to keep checking what you had coming in next. So I think that being a mix of both these sort of operating systems, I'd say that didn't work. You'd need to do it one way or the other way.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Lots more procedures though, coming from country to city, which you would expect, and even more so now in the job I'm at now. But you see things fall apart, and then you can see, oh, well, that's why we've got that procedure.
Yeah.
And then if it's not followed, you go, and that's why it's necessary, especially in terms of sort of warranty, that sort of stuff. Got to tick all the boxes because warranty is incredibly strict these days. I imagine it is with all brands. So if you don't tick all the boxes, they're going to reject your warranty claim, and that's money that has to come out of the workshop.
Well, I mean, that's a big challenge, isn't it? Where, you know, from your background and your expertise, having to, you know, your primary focus is to, you know, for the most part, I'm dumbing it down big time, but is to get a car working and get it back on the road.
Yep.
But to have those conflicting priorities where you've got that, yes, but you've also got this business side of it where there's money involved, where you've got to find that balance to make sure that all these different parties are happy. It can be that can be quite stressful.
Well, absolutely, because you have times where you might be, you know, really, really busy for a few months, and you can't really plan for breakdowns. So, you know, vehicles get towed in, car doesn't start, whatever. And the vehicle would be booked in for, you know, the next available appointment, but it's like more of a if we get to it sooner, we will, that sort of thing. But if you have a whole series of breakdowns within the span of a week when you're already super busy, you end up having all these carryover jobs that you sort of have to just push back because, you know, in an ideal world, when you get really backed up like that, you just sort of stop booking in retail work. But to keep the business running, you can't do that because warranty work and breakdowns, all these big jobs and stuff will be paid after the fact. Whereas, you know, your standard servicing and repairs, that sort of stuff brings the money in. So as much as you'd like to just sort of go, all right, let's just stop booking in work for a week, you can't do it because you still need to pay all the overheads and stuff. So you need to just sort of try and shuffle all the booked in, you know, sort of standard services and repair work, that sort of stuff, while trying to sort of get to the breakdowns when you can get to them. So that's, pretty big sort of juggling act. And it always comes down to sort of the customer as well. Some people are completely understanding of, oh, hey, I realised my car broke down and it wasn't booked in, so I'm happy to wait a week for you to look at it. Whereas other people don't quite have that attitude. and it's sort of frustrating because there are times where customers who aren't the nicest people in the world get pushed ahead of customers who are nice. Mm. And, you know, they might have been waiting a shorter amount of time, but at the end of the day, you've got to keep people happy.
Yeah.
So even though, you know, you'd rather go, well, this person was booked in and they're lovely, you sometimes have to go, well, actually, this person's just rocked up, but they're angry, so we've got to keep them happy. So I feel that angry customers almost get treated better sometimes, not telling people to go out and be angry because that's not a nice thing to do. But, you know, it is what it is. You've got to try and keep customers happy at the end of the day. So, yeah, it's just a bit of a juggling act. Yeah.
Do you have much involvement sort of face-to-face with customers these days, or is it more are you in the back end where you have, you know, other team members that would sort of be providing messages and communication with customers?
I'll deal with customers a little bit. You know, if there's an ongoing issue with a car that, I mean, I had one the other day. He'd been to another dealer and they couldn't fix it or they couldn't fault it. So, you know, went for a road test with him and it played up. So it was like, great, good. Because 9 times out of 10, I'll go for a road test with a customer and they're trying to show me what it does and it won't happen. And they're like, oh, I did it just this morning. I'm like, yeah, but it's Murphy's Law. Like, I'm here now, so it's not going to play up. I'll often, you know, go on a road test with a customer. We do have a designated road tester, but he's not technically qualified. So it can be a bit difficult sometimes because, you know, you almost need someone there to see it play up to know where to go from there, whereas he'll just say, oh yeah, what they're telling is true, but it doesn't give you much to go on. So yeah, for me it's more sort of speaking with customers. I might look at their vehicle and get to a point, and then I'll speak with the service advisor and say, do you have any more information for me? And you know, the customer might come in and I'll just have a conversation with them, just try and get a bit more information out of them so we know sort of which path to follow. But other than that, yeah, I'm generally just out the back, because you know we've got our service advisors and we've got, you know, a foreman, road tester, and a workshop controller. Any one of them could speak to customers as well if needed. But essentially, that's what the advisors are there for. So it's really only in more diagnosis sort of situations where they need to get myself or another tech involved.
I think people don't realise how many different like facets of a workshop there are in different roles. Like,
yeah.
You just think, yeah, if you're stereotyping, you're like, oh, there's the mechanic and probably the lady behind the counter that processes the payment.
Yeah.
That's about it. But there's all these different roles depending on what's going on. And I guess the larger the operation, the more people.
Yeah. And that's it. And this being a larger operation, you know, we've got receptionists and we've got a couple of drivers that will, you know, drop customers off and pick them up where they need to go. If they're, or you know, they take a loan car, that sort of thing. We've got concierge who essentially, you know, parks cars in the morning with have apprentices doing driveway service, and they're just sort of checking in vehicles and, you know, numbering them and just parking them because, you know, it's a massive number of vehicles coming in. And you just, yeah, you just need a couple people to spend a couple of hours physically moving those cars and parking them, because otherwise you'd end up with 20 or 30 cars just, you know, waiting in a queue around the corner to get served.
I've always been fascinated with, like, you know, if you go to the airport and you go and you park, like a park and fly sort of deal, and you watch their operation and how, like, from a logistical point of view, to sort of map out where to park cars and to do them in the order of the booking and when that person's going to come back and collect their car. And it's just absolutely incredible, because you think the operation involved to try and map that out is massive. And there would be an element of that at a dealership. Because, I mean, how many cars would you guys, you know, go through on a day?
We can have upwards of about 70 a day. We try to have it around 55, but that doesn't include vehicles that are already there.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can have 100 vehicles on site at any one time. And there is a certain, there's a little bit of that involved where people will, you know, because we've got indoor sort of car parking. We've also got a rooftop car park. So, you know, you might have the apprentices parking cars in the morning and they'll go, well, this one's going at 4 p.m. so I'll put it on the roof. Whereas the vehicles that are, you know, customers waiting around for, they'll park them directly in the workshop, or ones maybe going at lunchtime, they'll make sure they're accessible inside. But having said that, like, it's not really planned out. You sort of do what you can, but there are times where you go to get a car and you go, oh, hey, I'm triple parked, can you just move this one for me and get someone else to move that one? And that's, you know, that's not uncommon, but it's still because it's a big sort of site, it's still a better situation than my previous job where you didn't really have all those. It was a slightly smaller metro dealer, so you didn't have all those extra people to help out. So you'd essentially be moving the cars yourself. And when it was really busy, you'd be double parking in the workshop as well. So sometimes I did have a day once where I had to move 9 cars just so I could get my one car off my hoist and bring another car into my hoist. It was a process of about 4 other people helping me move 9 cars just to do that.
Not terribly efficient, but you know,
no, not at all.
Do.
It took. Well, I mean, do the maths. It took. I made a record of it this day because I was trying to sort of see what could be improved and taking notes and this, that, the other, and having meetings with the managers. And I took a note of that particular day. It took 20 minutes, and that was with me and 3 others. So you do the maths: 20 minutes times 4 people, time wasting just moving cars. You think about how much that cuts into profit and efficiency. Yeah, it's not ideal.
Absolutely. Just touching on, we were talking about customs a little bit before.
Yep.
Do you, over the time of being in Melbourne versus sort of in a more rural area, do you notice there's a different type of customer overall, if you're going to stereotype a little bit, as far as expectation, you know, the amount of time that the car's off the road? Is there a more sort of, I don't know, is there a little bit more of a higher expectation that people have?
Yeah. Yeah, there is. Actually, now that you mention it, it's what's sort of surprising is that, I mean, as you'd expect, people in the customer are a bit more chilled. And, you know, if I had a major repair going on or a diagnosis and they were without a car for a few weeks, they seem to be a bit more relaxed about it, whereas sort of city people would be frustrated and they'd want their car back immediately. But if you think about it, the country people would need their car more than those in the city.
That's so right.
It's sort of interesting that the ones – left without a car in the country, we're like, okay, yeah, when you've got it finished sort of thing, we could make other arrangements. Whereas in the city, that if it's even through no fault of our own or the manufacturer, they're demanding a loan car for free of charge and this, that and the other when there's plenty of public transport options available. So definitely a different, different type of customer, that's for sure. I also find in terms of sort of diagnosing repairs, country customers would sort of describe it and try to give you a go to show what was happening, whereas the city customers will always play the card of, well, I don't think it's safe to drive, so I need it fixed immediately. And sometimes, you know, fair enough, you know, it might be playing up and it's not safe, but there are other times where can't fault their car or what they're describing is just a normal operating system of the vehicle. But they sort of open it with, oh yeah, the other day I was in an intersection and then, you know, this happened and I just don't feel safe driving the car. And you go, okay, no worries, we'll look into it. But they, you know, they open with that because they just want the I think they want the VIP treatment, you know, to get in and out as quick as possible.
Yeah, and I think I mean, you touched on it really quickly, but it's the, and I hate to use the word because I've used it quite a bit over the years, the characteristic of a car, because when you're talking about road testing with the customer, and this is this is something that probably doesn't happen as much as it should, where if the technology in these cars is just exponentially just getting better and better, and
the cars are smarter than the people, that's for sure.
And people don't understand how a car functions anymore. And so people are still stuck in what a car used to be decades ago. And so the car's responding to a whole range of different things. And a lot of the technology is like adaptive as well. So if you're a pretty crap driver, then your car's probably going to respond in a pretty subpar way as well, because
absolutely,
it's only as good as the input that's being put into the car.
Yeah. So it's reading values that you're giving it. Yeah. And it's coming up with a basis on that. And that's what it'll get used to. So
do you see that in the road test where you sort of watch somebody driving and I'll certainly stereotype, you don't have to, but especially with our sort of older generations who
you're going to ask if they're left foot brake, aren't you?
Absolutely, because that was how they're taught, you know. And
my nana does it.
But you have to watch them do it.
I can't say I've ever seen it, but. You can't, you're right, you're absolutely right. You can't ask them, but every so often, you know, you might not get the customer in so you just yet, but the car will be in and you'll speak to an advisor and they'll describe the customer complaint or customer statement, I should say, because sometimes it's just a characteristic of the car, but they'll describe the customer statement. And there are times where you just have to ask immediately, do their left foot brake? Because what you're describing to me sounds like their left foot braking. And they go, oh, maybe I'll get them in for a road test. Because again, you can't ask them that. They're going to say no. But yeah, like we do exactly what you were saying with the characteristics of the vehicle. You do often get your cars coming in for their first year service. And you know, they've had it near on 12 months, but they maybe didn't understand, or because this is they can't be shown every feature of the car when they're handed over, because it would just take forever. Yeah. So they might either have not been shown something, or they just didn't remember it at the time and haven't bothered to open up the owner's manual. So then they come in for this first service, and it's obviously nothing that's bothered them too much because they didn't bother coming in earlier. But they'll come in and go, oh, can you check these five things that are wrong with my car? Bluetooth doesn't work, or my this, that, the other. And you go through them all and you go, all right, that's fine. That's just normal operation. That's a characteristic of the car. You have to give it back saying, yeah, it's all fine. But, you know, sort of explain to the advisor, it's probably best if you sort of explain a few of systems to them and how they work, because they're assuming it's something wrong with the car when it's actually just how the car is made to function. And they're just not aware of that because the technology has just surpassed, you know, just people's learning and their concept of how cars work, I guess.
Do you have to, I mean, oh, I'm going to take a stab in the dark and think that's probably a yes, but are you constantly having to upskill yourself as far as staying on top of all these changes that are happening with all these new vehicles that are coming out, the technology and the updates? And there's just so much happening, because it's not just, well, I've trained, I've got the expertise, and then that's it.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. So I'm constantly having to look things up in terms of new vehicles, because when it comes to a sort of a new vehicle, that's more of a sort of features of a vehicle are more of a sales side of things. So sales will go to a vehicle launch and they'll get to show, you know, they'll learn all about the fancy bells and whistles, whereas you'll go to a new model technical training, same car, and you'll learn how these systems work, but you won't necessarily learn how to use them. So oftentimes a car will come in and they go, this particular assist feature or infotainment feature or something isn't working. And there are times where I've had to go, right, well, I've never worked on this system before. So the first thing I do is pop open the glove box and check the owner's manual, which is something the customer hasn't done. And I go, all right, yep, oh, that's how that works. Cool. You know, hit a few switches and go, yeah, it's working. They just don't know how to turn it on. But I wouldn't have known that either, because if I've never seen that particular model before, it's not something you'd learn sort of a technical training. It's more of a sales thing. So there has been times where my go-to is the owner's manual, and it's like, oh cool, that's how you turn on this sort of feature of the GPS, easy done, no worries, we'll let them know. And you've just got to relay that to the customer, basically.
Do you get customers that come in and tell you how to fix the car?
Yeah, you do sometimes. Like you get you know, the classic, well, my friend, he's a mechanic and he told me that it's this. And you kind of go, all right, well, you know, we'll book you in for the diagnosis. Oh, no, but it's this. And you sort of say, well, we're not going to go off somebody else's word. Oh, but this is what's wrong with it. You go, okay, well, either you sort of agree to our diagnosis, and if that is the repair, we'll go ahead and we'll fix that. But if that's not what's wrong with it, we'll let you know. But it's like, oh no, just fix it. You go, well, no. Especially happens often with warranty as well. They'll go elsewhere and they'll come back, oh, I've been told that this is wrong. Oh, okay, who told you that? Oh, my mechanic. So why are you here? Oh, well, it should be covered by warranty. And you go, well, we'll have to do our own diagnosis because we can't take the word of a third party. Oh, but it's this. All right, well, why don't you take it back to your friend to fix it? You know, not that you'd ever say that to a customer, but geez, I wouldn't, I don't think I'd be able to hold my tongue that much if I was a service advisor.
I think you know, you've used the word a couple of times, diagnosis, which I, you know, several years ago, I would never put that word in the same sentence as like a mechanic. Like, diagnosis sounds like, a doctor, you know, going in the surgery, something like that. And but the technology and the complexity of a vehicle is so full on that it is a diagnosis. You've got to go searching, you know, to understand what's going on. You've got to search for problems in the car, and a lot of it's, you know, computer based as well.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. So, you know, people, I guess people without the knowledge love to think that, you know, cars these days, diagnosis is as simple as just, oh, you just plug in the computer and it tells you what's wrong, yeah? And I'm like, okay, you couldn't be further from the truth. But, I mean, yeah, we do plug in the computer sometimes and it'll tell us that there's a misfire fault. Brilliant. You've got something to go from. But that's sort of it'll sort of point you in a direction. Mm. But just a fault for a misfire could be anything from poor fuel to, you know, faulty spark plug or coil or an air leak or a stretched timing chain or even just, you know, piston rings that have shot themselves and needs a whole engine rebuild. You know, like it's not as simple as just plug the computer in and it's sorted. Mm. So, they've definitely the role of technology in diagnosing cars these days is really important. Like, without these diagnostic computers, you'd just basically be just throwing parts at a car to see what fixes it, you know. Whereas myself, I don't like to replace a part unless I'm 100% sure that that's what the problem is.
Mm.
So I'm more willing to spend more time checking all avenues before I'm confident of what it is to then replace a part. But if you didn't have that technology available, say, you know, being at a dealership, we have all these special tools and special diagnostic equipment that you wouldn't have at a corner garage, whereas a corner garage might just sort of throw parts at a car and hope it fixes it. And if it doesn't, then we often do get cars come in where it's, we've been elsewhere and we've done this, this and this and this, and they said that was all they could do and bring it into a dealer.
Clean up the mess.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like they sort of go as far as they possibly can with sort of their equipment and expertise and can't get to the bottom of the problem, so they'll sort of just handball it on elsewhere.
And you must go.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, just thinking back to your comment about the doctors earlier, remember many, many years ago, you know, hearing a story that someone would have made up, I'm sure, about the whole, oh, well, how come mechanics get paid so shit? Like, you know, we do the same thing as doctors. We're diagnosing problems, et cetera. And the response is like, yeah, try rebuilding an engine while it's running.
Yeah.
So I like to think of that one. Think of an engine as the beating heart of a car.
That's right.
That you just would not touch while it was running.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess also sort of on that sort of word diagnosis, you must absolutely hate the word Google when it comes to your job.
Because
like a GP or, you know, your local doctor, they probably must an ear bashing from patients.
Coming. Yeah.
I went on Google and typed in the symptoms and this is what I reckon it is. It's cancer.
Yeah.
And so, and it's the equivalent of cancer in my car. So this is clearly what it is because I've gone on Google and typed in my car and the problem that it's got.
Well, that's exactly as an example of what I've just said, like misfire. Imagine typing in misfire into Google. And the results that it's bringing up, because, you know, there's obviously forums and stuff and people go on there and they're talking to other people with similar cars that have had similar problems but don't have any of the expertise. So it's like, oh, I have this replaced, so that's probably what it is, when there can be a whole slew of problems or components that are actually causing it that might not be at all the same cause of what they're, you know, made on whatever their forum on Google is. I won't use any forum names, but anyway.
There's plenty out there for sure. But it's one of those things, like if it depends on your personality, because if you're pessimistic or optimistic, you'll find whatever's going to confirm those feelings. So as soon as you type it in, you're going to gravitate towards the article or the forum post or whatever that's going to appeal to you the most based on whatever your personality is. So if you're a pessimistic sort of person.
Oh, no, it's an engine rebuild.
You're going to go for the worst case scenario.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to use the term shifting gears, but I just said it. So anyway, shifting gears.
Yeah, nice one.
Yeah, I know. So where on earth or how on earth did the idea of being a mechanic or, you know, a vehicle technician, I don't know, what would you call yourself? And where did it come from? Was there a moment in time where you sort of thought, this is what I want to do, or did you just fall into it and just went with the flow?
I absolutely fell into it. And to answer one of the questions in the middle there too, they go by the term of automotive technician these days because they're trying to get away from mechanic. Because, you know, you speak to anyone, you know, a trainer or someone dealer based, and they go, oh, no, mechanics are just ones that spin filters at corner garages. Automotive technicians, you know, diagnose and repair vehicles. So, they try to go by automotive technician these days. But, you know, if I'm out at the pub and someone asks me what I do, I'm not going to fucking say that, am I? I'm just going to say I'm a mechanic and they're going to know what I'm talking about.
Sometimes just on that really quickly, I mean, you know, the horrible stereotypes from whether it be a mechanic or whether it be, you know, the salesman, the car salesman, those stereotypes that have been in pop culture for decades, you know, it's hard to shake a lot of that stuff and convince people. So I kind of get the terminology and people want to sort of shift it a little bit and use it as a slightly different term, but it depends on your setting, I guess, and who you're talking to.
It does make sense too, because just as we were saying, like with the sort of the importance of technology and stuff in cars, well, a mechanic these days isn't the same as what a mechanic was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So I guess the term's changing to sort of keep up with the changing technology in the vehicles.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. But I had never planned on being a mechanic. I definitely fell into it. So, you know, I finished high school, worked for a few years, had grand plans of going to uni and studying photography, which I obviously never did. and I moved up to Canberra in 2010, sorry, to live with my sister. You know, wanted to learn the basics of cars. Had a shitty, well, my first car was an old car. I wanted to know how to fix it. So I went to enroll in a pre-apprenticeship course at TAFE. But I got there, and then on enrollment day, I got offered a job. So I was like, I sort of brushed it off and went home and told my sister, because I was in hospitality at the time, while I was sort of figuring out what I was doing, if I was going to go to uni or whatever. And, you know, I'd gone to enroll in this pre-apprenticeship course and sort of came home and said to my sister, oh, yeah, you know, one of the trainers offered me a job. And she goes, well, why not? She goes, no offense, but you're not really doing anything else. And she said, why don't you, you know, get paid to go to TAFE and learn a trade rather than paying to go to TAFE? And I was like, yeah, good point. So I started the pre-apprenticeship course while this trainer set me up with a job, which was great because he did the ring around to all his mates and stuff, and he ended up getting me a job, well, an interview at the nearest dealer to my house, which is about a 10-minute drive away. So started there. And hated Canberra, so moved back home and just continued on. Yeah,
but, I mean, that sort of moment where you thought, "I want to learn about cars." I mean, what happened? I mean, I know you said you had a bit of a shitbox of a car, but what was there ever an inkling of an interest in cars leading up to that point? I mean, was there something that sort of happened and your car shit itself, and you were frustrated because you couldn't fix it yourself, and that sort of motivated you? I mean, regardless, and I'm going to touch on it later, but regardless of sort of gender, I think for most people, I think they won't sort of just go, well, yeah, I wouldn't mind learning about that. So what, was there something that sort of pushed you in that direction?
The car that I had, which still is in my ownership out at my mum's paddock, is a 1964 Morris 1100.
Wow.
I bought it when I was 17. And mum convinced her to buy it. It was like $200, but it was the bane of my existence for about 4 years because it didn't get on the road until I was 21.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a car in that meantime, and it's just an ongoing saga. But I think, you know, as a teenager and stuff, well, I obviously had an interest in older cars just because I like older things as I like, you know, older architecture, older music, all that sort of stuff. Had an interest in sort of vintage cars, classic cars. but still hadn't really thought about anything further than that. So it wasn't until I had one that I was like, well, I wouldn't mind learning the basics so I can fix it. But even then, I hadn't considered doing it as a career. Like I said, when I was off the job, I just sort of laughed it off. I was like, yeah, righto. That's not something I'd ever considered. So people always assume that, you know, I grew up fixing cars with my dad and, you know, have all this experience. And I'm like, nah, I literally knew nothing about cars the day I walked in to start my job.
And, I mean, it's not that long ago either. I mean, it's,
no.
I mean, mind you, time moves really quickly these days. And I think, oh, you know, 2010's not that long ago, but it was 8 years ago. So you're getting closer to a decade. But, yeah, I mean, that's a lot that's happened in that space of time. And, you know, for you to rock up and then just be offered a job, I mean, with you hadn't even started studying. You hadn't started doing anything. So, I mean, what'd you do?
I just said g'day, had a bit of a chat. I think that trainer was just sort of just on the lookout for new apprentices to start. Because he was a TAFE teacher, but he trained a particular brand at TAFE through their own sort of program. Right. So, you know, and they had about five sites around Canberra. So he was sort of on the lookout for new apprentices to start on. So, I guess that's sort of a good place to poach them, isn't it? I hadn't really thought about that before. But,
if you
skip the pre-apprenticeship course, just start the apprenticeship and we'll teach you what you need to know, I guess.
There you go, hot tip.
Mm.
So, I mean, when you started there and you started as an apprentice, I mean, what do you do? Like, what do you sort of just sit there and sort of help carry things around, or I mean, what sort of?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's different for everyone, and I think it mostly depends on the size of the workshop. But yeah, in Canberra, it was very much in the morning. I think we started at 8 o'clock, so I'd be paired up with someone qualified for all of half an hour, and then I'd do the courtesy drop off for all the customers, so that could take anywhere from half an hour to 2 hours. I'd come back for probably on average maybe another half hour and go back to that tech, and then have to go do the smoko run because we had a full-on like sort of lunch order system. So you know, the first year apprentice would get in the car and they'd drive down to pick up everyone's smoko. And then you'd come back and then you'd work for another hour or so and it was lunchtime. And then, you'd jump back on for another little while and then you'd have to do the afternoon pickup. So most of the day was just spent driving around. And then when you were sort of working with that qualified person, you're sort of, going to go get quotes, going to go get parts, handing them tools, like not a lot of hands-on stuff. But having said that, I was only there for 4 months before I did end up moving back home. And then getting back down to Wodonga, where I'm from, was completely different because it was a small workshop. So I got hands-on experience in everything from the moment I walked in the door, basically. So I was really lucky being in that workshop during my apprenticeship, because there are people that are just sweeping floors for 2 years, whereas by the end of my second year I was really rebuilding engines, you know, like just lucky to be in a small workshop that had opportunities to sort of teach you everything you need to know.
Apart from the crap weather in Canberra, was there anything else that, I mean, what was the big reason for getting out of Canberra? Was it part that that dynamic of how the apprenticeship sort of was set up there in Canberra wasn't exactly what you were hoping for, and that, or was it just a whole heap of things?
I didn't mind working there at all. It was just the place, to be honest. I mean, I was still working in hospitality as well, so that probably had a big thing to do with it, because I'd do Friday, Saturday nights I'd be working, and often another one or two nights during the week, so I'd finish one job, go to the next. So I didn't know many people, because, as you can imagine, there weren't many, male or female peers my age when I was working in a workshop. So didn't really meet any people. The few friends I had there were the people I worked with at the restaurant, but all we'd ever do was sort of go out for a drink after work, because I was working, sometimes 60, 70 hours a week. So, I don't know. I guess I guess there was a lot of different factors, but no, it wasn't the apprenticeship at all. It was just the place and I guess my particular circumstance. But I don't know, a whole bunch of things, I suppose.
Was there any point in time since then, and you know, moving back to Wodonga and in a different workshop, and even just relocating to Melbourne and being where you are now, that you sort of thought that what this is what you want to do? Or are you sort of still on that path where it's like, this is, you know, you're sort of growing, you're learning things as you go, but who knows what the future is going to hold? Like, are you sort of, is this sort of cementing yourself now as far as this is?
Yeah, this is definitely. Thing? Definitely the latter. I generally always have a goal. So in Wodonga, it was, you know, finish the apprenticeship. That was the goal. Moved to Melbourne and then went through, the goal was to become a master tech. So went through, did that. And then, I suppose there was another goal in there, but that was the previous workplace. So that, you know, didn't come to fruition. But, you know, changing brands, it's, again, now I suppose my goal is to get back up to master tech, and after that sort of see what happens. Because without a goal, it's a bit difficult. I do remember when I first moved to Melbourne, just sort of being like, well, is this it? Like, what am I doing? Like, is this my life now? It's like, it's not very challenging. I'm just sort of, oh, okay, just servicing cars, like, yeah, it's not the worst thing, but it wasn't very challenging, and I just sort of thought, do I want to keep doing this? Do I want to work at a dealer? Do I want to do this as a job? Do I finally go study photography, you know? And then I got put through onto the master tech training, and as soon as I had that goal, all was right again. Because I guess I'm not a very goal-based person, but it wasn't until that moment that I realised I'd always had a goal. And without one, it was suddenly, well, what next? Even just, you know, after I did finish my apprenticeship, the goal was always to eventually move to Melbourne. And, you know, yeah, once I'd done that, it was like, well now what's next?
In a general sense, what entails being a master tech?
I guess the best way to describe it, would be that you're sort of the go-to person. You don't necessarily need to have all the knowledge, but you need to be able to find and access that knowledge and then relay it onto the appropriate person. You know, I might have another tech say, oh, have you seen this problem before? Oh, well, yeah, I have. This is what I've found, you know, explain it to them in technical terms, or, you know, you've got to show a first year apprentice something, or you've got to then, have a conversation with a customer and sort of explain it in a term that they'll understand it. But if someone comes to you and asks the question, you've got to be able to sort of find the answer for them, if that makes sense. But essentially it is, you know, you're the number one sort of person diagnosing cars, because it can get pretty complicated. And, you know, you go to all the training, and once you've done the training, it makes an absolute world of difference. Just my own abilities from when I started my master tech training to the end was just like, from the beginning to the end, like I wouldn't have even dreamt of being able to understand half the shit I did at the end that I did at the start. But yeah, it's all just sort of comes down to training and learning new information and that sort of stuff.
Have you always been sort of a keen learner in the sense that, you know, if you've got information in front of you, you'll digest it? Or was that something that just through environment of, you know, going into this whole apprenticeship thing and going through each step that you sort of built that appreciation for it? Because for me, like, I love to learn something, but I'll do it very casually in my own time. But as soon as there's structure to it and there's a bit of formality to it, I turn into the 14-year-old delinquent that doesn't like being told what to do.
So I'm probably the opposite. Give me some structure and I'll go for it. Like when I first moved back to Wodonga, I had to go to TAFE for 6 months before I could be enrolled in brand training. And this was midway through the year, so the class I got put in, there was 10 other students. They'd all been there since the start of the year. And it was very much a bludge day, you know, people just sort of took it as a day off. So I went in and it was sort of self-paced, you know, you just did what your modules and got them signed off when you were finished. So I was there for about 2 months and I'd overtaken the rest of the class who'd been there for 8 months. And that was just because, you know, they just didn't really care. But I was like, right, well, if I've got all this information in front of me and this is what I've got to learn and this is what I've got to tick off, I'll just do it at home, you know. Like I did the same thing when I then went up through block release, you know, week-long blocks for training through the brand, and did the same thing, just spent hours and hours at home going, you know, I'll get as much of this done now as I can rather than later, and it paid off. You know, we were meant to bring in, you know, 6 job cards per block, and, you know, 2 modules a block, 3 job cards throughout the 3 years. And, you know, the second or third block we went up there, I handed in about 25 job cards that ticked off nearly all my first and second year and part of my third year. But if I've got the work now, like, I'll just get it ticked off now rather than waiting till later, you know. So if there's some kind of structure, I sort of thought this is where you were leaning towards. I'll get into that 14-year-old nerd and sit at home and study. But otherwise, I always have grand intentions of, I should look into this, you know, when I get home, and I never do. So if I've got structure and a goal, then I'll go for it. But otherwise, I'm sort of pretty casual and learn when I need to. You know, if the car's in front of me and I suddenly don't know about an operating system, I'll learn about it then.
Yeah, for sure. It's one of those things where I get thrown back, you know, a couple of decades really quickly when I find myself in a setting where I've got to learn something for whatever reason, mm-hmm. and there is structure to it. There's a formality attached to it, and I guess a little bit of pressure. I mean, the pressure is sort of fabricated in a way because really it just comes down to yourself. You're putting the pressure mm-hmm. on, but you feel that there's an obligation being put on from other people. And it's one of those weaknesses that I have where I just instantly go to this rebellious sort of thing where I'm deliberately trying to self-sabotage because I don't like being told what to do. And it's just, and you know, I've got this feeling it's always going to be there and it's always just going to be eating at me. But I like to think I've gotten better over the years, but every once in a while I find myself in a similar setting again where I'm learning something new and I'm being challenged, but I'm in that sort of more formal environment. I think, all right, you need to rein it in a bit here and, try your best. I mean, this is for your own benefit, but you kind of, at least for me, I forget about all of that. And I just, it's a little bit more of a, I don't know, a bit of an attack of the ego or something like that, where you realize that, you know, you don't know it all.
Yep.
Going back to stereotypes, and I'll stereotype big time. When you think about mechanics or automotive technicians, you don't, and I think it's getting better these days, but mm-hmm. you tend to not expect a woman to be in that role just from years gone by.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you ever, like, when you made that decision to go and study and go into the apprenticeship, did you ever have any of those thoughts about this is something that, I don't know, friends and family or just, you know, the stranger in the street would think this is an unusual thing for me to do? Or did you even see, like, on that whole pathway along the way that you sort of felt like this was something a little bit more unique for you? Or did you see a lot of examples around you?
It's funny because when I first got told my friends about the apprenticeship, I had multiple guys, like male friends, go, that's just perfect for you. Like, well done. Yeah, that's so you. And I was like, really? Like, it's not something I ever, you know, imagined doing. So why are you suddenly telling me that it suits me, you know? I mean, I did have, like, you know, in the first job up in Canberra, I had one guy grilling me about how I did in school and this, that and the other, and he was telling me to get out while I couldn't go be a doctor. Like, don't waste your time. You can earn more money. Get out. Don't do this. Don't do this. It's a terrible decision. I've definitely never regretted the decision, so I'm glad I didn't listen to him. But I don't know. I don't really know how to answer that question, to be honest.
No, I guess it's just because it's, I guess, from the outside looking in, and it would be a different story being in the thick of it. But, you know, because those stereotypes have been there, and I know it's changing. I mean, I've certainly seen, you know, there's far more, I wouldn't say a balance, but there's
no,
far
there's
more,
not a balance.
No, but there is a bit more presence, I guess, is probably a better way to explain it. But have you ever, I mean, what's your experience as being on that side and sort of going through this whole journey of learning something which would be challenging in its own right, but something that stereotypically, you know, might be a little bit of an unusual sort of place for you to be?
Well, I mean, I don't really think about it that much now, but I guess when I first started out, like I, and this is probably, this is one of the things you hear from people a lot that have known female mechanics that say they're usually better because there's this sense of trying to prove yourself. Do you know what I mean? Like wanting people to take you seriously. And I mean, I certainly did that in this first year of my training because, you know, I turned up with all that work and no one else had, and they sort of went, well, hang on, what's this about? And, you know, it got me an award, you know, I got Apprentice of the Year in that first year. So I think that was sort of enough to go, yeah, hey, you know, just sort of showing you that you know, you don't have to be male and have that male sort of mind or way of learning or thinking about vehicles to be able to sort of learn and sort of do the job anyway.
I think as much as people would hate to admit it, you know, I think there's certainly big differences in the way that men approach situations and women approach situations. And I think there's a, I think that's why that dynamic together can work so well. And maybe this is part of a reason why there's been so many bad stereotypes from years gone by, decades of a bunch of blokes in a workshop stereotypically, you know, maybe cutting corners or not having the attention to detail that's deserved.
I was going to say those both two points.
And then having, I don't know. I mean, I can only speak on my own sort of experiences, but I think having a little bit of a balance or a little bit of a dynamic there, it makes everybody a little bit more accountable, I think, and a little bit more responsible of their role and their spot in whatever that setting is. So, you know, obviously having more women in any workplace, but especially in that sort of place, would definitely help, I guess, raise the bar, I reckon.
Yeah, I agree.
Talking about technology, things are changing so quickly.
Yeah.
E-mobility and electric cars.
Yeah.
Are you exposed to a lot of that?
Not currently, but I will be because there'll be more coming out sort of in the next few years. But certainly, you know, electric cars are the way of the future. And, it's just – and autonomous vehicles, like they already exist, they're already there. It's just that the cars are sort of ahead of technology and sort of, I guess, most countries and that sort of stuff. We'll be seeing cars that are capable of a lot of things that there's just not going to be infrastructure or legislation for. So, the next few years will be interesting because we will be seeing a lot more sort of electric vehicles coming through. You know, I think diesel's on the way out, and it's going to be a slow shift for, I would say, most brands. They'll have to end up going that way. But yeah, then it's the interesting thing of how are we going to cope with that? You know, where are we going to have these charging ports? You know, are we going to change servos to, you know, rather than just gas pumps, is it going to be where you can plug your car in, or are they going to come up with technology where you can just charge it in your garage overnight, that sort of stuff? Like it's all sort of happening, but we're just not going to know what's going to come out, what's going to be available sort of until it happens. We'll just have to wait and see, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think even from like a work, like your traditional workshop point of view, that will completely
that will die
as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's things that can't repair.
Give it 15 years, and who knows? You might only be able to go to a dealership to get your car fixed.
Yeah.
I mean, Australia's a bit different, I suppose, because we don't have any emissions laws. But over in the UK, that sort of stuff, they're not driving 20-year-old cars, so they're only going to be driving newer cars, and therefore they'll only be going to dealerships. It's a bit different in Australia. You still have corner garages, but I think a lot of them will die out just because they won't have that, they won't have the technology or the expertise to sort of deal with what's next to come. Yeah.
I think my big money-making scheme, and I mean, I have not obviously thought this through enough, but it's got to be something around e-mobility, and it's got to be something around maintenance of the vehicle that hasn't been accounted for yet, because the cars are going to be so simplistic in nature for the most part.
Yeah.
There's not going to be a lot of moving parts in there, so your maintenance is going to be relatively low, but you're going to have to complement the car with something some form of service or product that's going to be able to complement these vehicles. And that's the big problem. I don't know what it is yet, but when I work it out,
I'll
cash it in.
When you work it. Yeah, right. Yeah, no, it'd be a good idea.
Oh, cool. Well, I'm going to wrap it up. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to reach out to Lara, I'm going to put a few links and details in the show notes over at andysocial.net. I might try and find some videos something about motor vehicles or something like inside a dealership or inside a modern workshop, just to give you guys a bit of a visual as to what some of this stuff looks like. I don't know. I'll have a look. If I don't find anything, no, don't shoot the messenger. I'm going to see what I can find and dump some stuff in the show notes. So go over and check that out over at andysocial.net. I really hope you enjoyed that chat with Lara. It was really, really cool to chat to her about something that, well, I'm not a technician. I've got no idea. So, as always, asking a bunch of dumb questions and just seeing where it goes. So really hope you enjoyed that chat. And thanks so much to Lara for giving me that time to talk a little bit about her day job. Few updates. Lord.net.au. Plug, plug, plug. New album's coming soon. I'm going to tell you something. So not too long ago, I put up a video on the Lord Facebook page, and it's a video of Australian comedian Aaron Gox, and he's giving Mark Furtner a little bit of a light roast. Now, talking about the new album, all I'm going to say is, if you've got some time, go and check out that video, because there might be a little, I don't know, maybe there's a little teaser in there. I don't know. Anyway, go and check it out if you haven't watched it already, because there might be something in there. Now, I'm not sure, because I'm recording this a little bit in advance now, but I don't know whether the album's going to be announced yet, but we are getting very close to releasing that first single. And I know I've been talking about it for the last couple of months, but we are getting closer. It's just been finishing off the video clip, which has been a massive, massive piece of work for Tim. So we filmed it in mid-November, and Tim's been finishing off the album, which is the main priority, but then also finishing off this video clip as well. So a lot of work. I wish I could sort of share some of that workload, but I've got no idea how to do video clips, so or finish off an album. So I'm going to leave that to Tim to do that stuff and get him to do it in his time. But hopefully we won't be too far off. Single should come out really soon. I'm so excited for you guys to hear it. It's a real kick to the face and a big welcome back for us. So really hope that you guys enjoy it when it comes out. But go to lord.net.au. In the meantime, you can go and check out all of our music over there if you haven't heard us yet. Make sure you're following us and subscribing to all the socials so you're up to date as soon as those announcements come out. But I'll keep you guys up to date on this podcast as well, although who knows, it might be a bit delayed depending on when I record these. Self-starter. Same sort of deal. We're in between season one and season two. I'll keep mentioning it all through the year, but season two kicks off in June of 2019 this year. If you've got any suggestions for season two, I'm going to record the entire season. Well, I'm planning to, I'm hoping to record it all in advance. So if you've got any suggestions of people that own their own business, run their own business, or about to have a really cool side hustle and make money in a really unusual way, something like after hours, nothing sus. And maybe somebody that, I don't know, somebody that's just doing freelance work or anything like that, shoot me some suggestions, because I'm going to try and record the entire season two before it launches in June of this year. So keep the suggestions coming. You can continue to listen to season one. It's going to be up and available for at least up until June anyway, and then I'll make a decision as to whether I package that up and, you know, archive it or whatever, but we'll see what happens. And blog posts are coming as well. So that's my big challenge for the first half of this year. So we'll see how that goes. But that's it, folks. Another episode done. Thank you so much. Got lots of cool guests coming up. Thank you so much for the encouragement. Keep those guest recommendations coming. And I asked a question last episode as well. So have you thought about it? Maybe go back and listen to the last episode in the outro. Right at the end, I asked a question. I wouldn't mind getting your feedback. So yeah, go back and listen to it and see what it is. Anyway, until next week, folks, take care. Ta-ta. Bye-bye. Larry, please.